Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. In 1979, a disposal pond full of uranium mine tailings spilled 1,000 tons of radioactive mill waste into the Puerco River, which flowed to the Navajo Nation. The area had been a center of uranium mining since the Cold War. It has left a toxic legacy for area residents, and it has forced many families to relocate and leave their ancestral lands. But one community wanted more options. The Dinette Redwater Pond Road community turned to design experts at the University of New Mexico to see what was possible. I'm joined today by Catherine Page Harris, Assistant Professor of Landscape Architecture and Art and Ecology, and Michaela Shirley. She works with the Indigenous Design and Planning Institute, and she comes from Kinlichi, Arizona, on the Navajo Nation. Also joining us by phone is Teresita Keyana, and she is a liaison for the Redwater Pond Road community. And Shunanda Sharmin is here as well. She's a UNM graduate student studying landscape architecture. Teresita, I understand that there are about 7 families in the community, and you've been told by officials with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency that you need to relocate. What does your community want to see happen?
Our community wanted to move closer to its current location, and it's about a mile up just from our current location now. But if you go by the road, and it's maybe about 5 miles going by road. We've tried to work with our local electric company and our local water company, and they don't want to do it, even though there's money there to help them actually get all this done. So it's kind of just hard for the community to just hear that constantly, is that constant no. In the very beginning, when the EPA first approached us, they asked us what did we want. We told them that we wanted the waste moved away, off site, away and far away, and yet it's only being moved about 1.5 miles away from the community. And then they said that they couldn't do that. So we said we wanted to move on top of the mesa because it's close to home. It's where our family's from. And it's a place where we can practice our culture and not be disturbed by city life. And so that's something that we asked for. And again, we've been hit with a brick wall, and the answer is no.
So they would be willing to move, give you relocation funds to move to a place like Gallup or something like, which some families have done. But I gather that's not what you want.
That's not what a lot of the community wants. A lot of the community is still tied to that land, or we all are tied to the land. It's just that some of the families know that, you know, it's impossible to have the government change their mind. We've always said that once they make that plan, they've already made that plan. They're not planning on going back on it.
And has your community had suffered health effects from this?
Yes, many people have suffered some asthma, some cancers, constant attack of pneumonia and COPD. My grandmother had passed away from pulmonary fibrosis. Some locations where a cleanup has happened, some of the people have actually gotten better after the cleanup.
How big is this community? How many people are we talking about?
Maybe about 120 to 130.
Let me turn to Catherine. What are you guys trying to do with the community?
A couple of representatives from the community came to the Indigenous Design and Planning Institute 6 years ago, and was interested in potentially visioning how they could move up to this mesa top and what would it entail given the lack of utility availability. And at the time, they were unsure exactly about how they wanted to proceed, and they came back about a year ago and said, you know, we really do want to proceed with this idea. And then Michaela and Ted Hohola came to me and said, you know, would you be interested in taking this on for your studio? And the studio I teach in the fall in landscape architecture is a sustainable, resilient communities studio that usually deals with regional character. So usually looking at something within the Southwest. And it was a fabulous, amazing opportunity to kind of play out those questions.
So it actually gives your students and you an opportunity to take a real world project and work, apply possible solutions.
So they were incredibly wonderful hosts. We came up and camped overnight and the students got to see what it would be like to wake up in the morning and, you know, spend the night there. And we had fabulous meals that we brought some of and they brought some of, and we all got together and ate and got to know everybody. And the basic gist is that we started out with a core of 7 houses, and we looked at basically the requirements for how to build out that community, assuming a completely off-the-grid possibility, assuming that really the answer was no, that we would never be able to bring the electricity or water into that space. So we were looking at rainwater collection and sizing the roofs and whether they were house or sort of outbuildings in order to be able to create a system that would, you know, provide the what we came down to is, I think, 25 gallons per day per person, which is super low in the United States, and really requires reusing water at least once, you know, during the process inside the house. We looked at all solar panel electricity generation. The houses have to be passive solar, you know, sort of taking advantage of what we have up there and using both the landscape and the house as a way, an integrated system. So we work with kind of these resilient systems. So we ended up in the studio with 3 plans, looking at clustering the housing or dispersed housing or a kind of one big cluster around an area that needs kind of erosion control work in order to continue to make it a kind of sustainable space. And the community is really interested in sort of 2 plans. So at the moment, we actually got a lovely grant from the Indian Land Tenure Foundation, and it was matched by a grant from the OVPR's office here,
what does that stand for?
The Office of the Vice President of Research Office gave us a grant. And so those 2 have been sustaining graduate students to work on this project both spring and summer and create a final plan, a website, and using VR, create these walkthroughs so that people can understand what this space could be like.
Virtual reality?
Virtual reality. Oh, I should mention that we also received a grant from the Center for Regional Studies to photograph individual plants on that site and actually another site as well in Navajo to get a kind of range of plant material and change them into 3D models that can go into this VR walkthrough that would there and then also include the stories of the people about those specific plants and what they might be used for as kind of a library for the school. And that we hope will altogether create a package that the community can go and really make a pitch to either fundraising resources, since it seems like the federal government is potentially not going to, you know, sort of follow through on this as a plan, or and also industries that like solar panel providers and, you know, potentially filters and things for the water systems, and try to actually see if this project can happen in some way that maybe uses some of the EPA funding that they're required to give to these people, but doesn't rely only on that. And so can be more independent and the community can get what they really want as opposed to what's sort of being offered.
I wanted to turn to your graduate student, Shunanda Sharman.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You have been working on this. You're from Bangladesh originally. How did you get involved in working on this? What has this been like?
When you are a designer, usually you are just sitting on your desk and designing something. But in this case, we got to see the community, how they live, and their story. We also thought about the systems and how it will play into the design. So for me, that part was really interesting because they decided a lot of our decisions that we were making for the master planning. And now I'm working as a graduate student, as an employee of this project. So now it's not just designing for a studio. We are more thinking more in detail how it's going to be realized, what needs to be focused. We are looking at numbers again. So I think I got a like full spectrum of the whole process about designing and then actually building it and also understanding and interacting with the community. It's been very interesting and rewarding.
Michaela Shirley, you are with the Indigenous Design and Planning Institute. Tell me about that and how you came to be involved in this. Sounds like it first came through you.
Over at IDPI, we started in 2011, and this was spearheaded by our director, Dr. Ted Hohola. He's a Tsleta Pueblo. And really the intent of our institute is meant to help facilitate, you know, a person's educational learning experience. So that means engaging with the faculty, the students, professionals, and policy leaders in like culturally appropriate design and planning practices. I was coming in as a graduate student in the planning program. And so, you know, similar to Shinanda, I, you know, got involved with a lot of like Indigenous planning and design work. It just seemed like a natural sort of like fit to also want to help extend another Navajo community, because Navajo Nation is a pretty expansive reservation. We're comprised of about 110 Navajo chapters. And so there's all of these different levels of bureaucracy that, you know, the community is dealing with. And so IDPI, we tend to work with communities that often are overlooked. And you know, oftentimes, even within the planning process, there's exclusion of community voices in that. And so Catherine Studio really coming in and like helping, you know, raise that voice of the seven families that want to stay there was extremely important. And we're thankful for all the work that she's been able to do for that.
Talk about why it's important to bring in the perspective of Indigenous design.
For Indigenous planning, it's been a field that's been predicated on seven generations approach. So looking at the community, thinking long term is, you know, thinking of yourself as the middle person or the middle generation. And then there's three generations before you, which is your parents, your grandparents, and your great grandparents. And then the three generations after you, which are your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. And so throughout that planning and design process, all of those generations should be present and have a voice in that vision for what they want for their future. And it's predicated on three principles. So the first principle is that we are not minorities in our communities, meaning that we have a tendency to not see ourselves as smaller people because we make up a majority of the population in the places that we occupy. And then second, we don't suffer from cultural amnesia, meaning that we always retain our culture, our traditions, and our language, and that's what we're hoping that would inform the planning and design process. And then the third one, the people are beautiful already. You know, a lot of the times when we're working with Indigenous community, it's a deficit thinking approach. We don't have this, we don't have that, we're suffering in this, we're suffering in that. But no, it's like we are coming from a place of empowerment, because it's the assets in our community, like our culture, like our language, families, traditions, that are keeping us strong and resilient.
This is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm speaking with Catherine Page Harris, Assistant Professor of Landscape Architecture and Art and Ecology at UNM. Also with us is Michaela Shirley, who works with the Indigenous Design and Planning Institute at UNM. Also in the studio is Shunanda Sharman. She's a graduate student in landscape architecture. And by phone, we have Teresita Kayana from the Redwater Pond Road community in western New Mexico. We're talking about efforts to relocate that community, which is being threatened by uranium mine tailings. The community is working with the Indigenous Design and Planning Institute and with Catherine Harris, who does a sustainable community design project in her studio classes. Teresita, what was your experience working with people like Michaela and Catherine to meet the needs for your community?
They're really easy to talk to. They're much easier to talk to than the EPA. So that's always a good thing. We, as a community, we don't like to talk to the EPA because they kind of always like to speak above us, and they don't like to speak to us. They're always speaking above our head, and sometimes we don't understand that. A lot of our elderly have not gone to school. It wasn't available to them. And so for the EPA to speak to them in such a way, it's, for us, it's disrespectful, because we need our elders to understand everything that we're doing as a community. We don't want to leave them out. And another thing is we don't want to leave our children out of this whole conversation. I constantly teach our children that they have a voice. Even though politicians don't want to listen to them, they still have a voice. They get to say what they want. And we try to make sure that everybody at the table is in an understanding point so that we don't leave anybody behind.
Catherine, what are some of the challenges you're facing bringing these plans to completion?
The vision is thoroughly exciting. I think, you know, the challenges that are associated with it have a large part to do with just trying to help everyone be clear in the process about what it would take. If you're at 25 gallons a day per person of water, you're looking at probably not a 10-minute shower, you know. Like, you're going to be having to be very clear with yourself about why you would want to be there and what it's worth to you. The biggest challenge for me has been trying to articulate the pieces of information that Shananda and another graduate student, you, who's been working with us, and the whole studio, and we were all working together. We kept coming through these various decision points where we would say, wow, that implies a certain kind of commitment. And being able to articulate that and have a conversation with the elders in the community about what is, you know, what's feasible, what's doable, what fits with their sense of what's beautiful, you know, all of that, because there's no point in building something that nobody wants to live in. Working with this process has been really just extraordinary in terms of trying to learn exactly what the issues are and then trying to learn how they are best approached so that everyone will be comfortable with the final set of decisions. I think a thing we talked about a lot in class was, you know, helping people feel joyful and heard and like the choices that were being made were expressing what their culture is and what they would really want. You know, we are equipped and being helped by the university and by outside funding to come up with, you know, the best solutions we can offer, but they really are coming from the community itself and, you know, what they're willing to be a part of.
Is there a timeline?
So the timeline for us right now is that we want to be finished with this work by the end of July. The putting in of the plants into the virtual reality model may move on into the next year just because we'd like to get more than one season, you know, to photograph them right now. Well, it's great because it's monsoon, so everything's really green. But they will change, and, you know, so we need to be able to articulate some of that. But basically, we should be done, you know, sort of before school starts. And then that.
And when you say done, you mean done with all the possible plans and
all the possible
virtual
plans.
Reality.
Yeah,
model.
The virtual reality model. And so we'll be handing over a book. And then it's really good that you asked about the question of done, because at the moment, I'm feeling like I'm not really done until I've done my absolute best to facilitate bringing in funding that would help really build this forward. And we have the potential of using, there's a program in the School of Architecture and Planning called EcoMod, and it takes a sort of two-year process to actually build physically a modular home that can be moved to a site. So right now we have one that Habitat for Humanity that's going to be moved to a site in Barelas. And I'm working with John Qualley, who's the director of architecture, to talk about this as a possible build-out for it. It would, as you can probably all calculate in your own heads, be a really slow way to get the community up on the mesa, because that would be 14 years worth of building. But I think it's a good potential start, and it might be a way for us to build a prototype and have that prototype then get built out by maybe some benevolent firm that's willing to think about that as a huge contribution to the culture of the Southwest. So that's a potential, you know, like completely pie in the sky at the moment, but it's rooted in some real possibility here in the school.
Teresita, those are a lot of challenges and maybe a lot of shifts in how people are used to living. Do you think how is the community taking in that information and working with that future?
Most of our community that are in the older age range all understand how to survive on the 25 gallons of water. When they grew up, they didn't have running water. They didn't have electricity. So these are the things that we already know how to live without. Just to be able to have 25 gallons of water is awesome.
I take your point. People are very resilient in your part of the country, in New Mexico. Shunanda, I'm curious how this experience has been for you as a student, and what, as you go through your course and graduate, go out into the world, what will you take from this experience?
I think the biggest takeaway is interacting with the community. As I said before, it's not about just designing in a laptop or in a computer. It's not that. Your decisions are affecting people's life. I think acknowledging that, understanding that, and taking responsibility for that, and making informed decisions through this process. So I think that is my biggest takeaway from this whole process.
I wanted to sort of add in that one of the things that was, so I went out this weekend to this commemorative walk that the Redwater Pond Road community has created. This was the 9th, I believe, and it was the 39th anniversary of the day the dam broke and the uranium tailings went downstream. Actually, the vice president of the Navajo Nation came, and it was sort of this amazing moment where I think people really did feel heard, and he was taking pictures and sort of taking in the information really in a way that sort of indicated to me that not only was he concerned and interested, but that it was not new and that he hadn't known that it existed before, mm-hmm. but that it was visually new, like being able to be presented with, because these tailings piles are like the size of the Big Eye. They're huge. They're not just little minor little piles of soil. They're,
stories high.
Three stories high with these kind of frail little lines of erosion control fabric on them. And they're really impressive in that sort of, you imagine living in a house where, you know, everybody wipes their feet when they walk in the door at whatever age they are because they know that they don't want to track the dust in.
Teresita, I'll give you the last word. I know there's a couple different plans in process, but what would the best solution look like for your community?
The best solution would be for them to actually listen to us and move that whole waste pile somewhere else, and along with it, take that tailings pile along with it. And not only that, but also take the pile that's from Kermigee, currently Quivira Mine. That's another waste pile that the community just gets to look at every day. And I'd like that to be all moved to an actual current facility, not basically making a new repository in our community. That's something that we don't want.
Okay, well, I want to thank you all for coming and talking about this.
Thank you so much, Megan. Really
thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, Teresita.
Thank you. You're welcome.
That was Teresita Kayana. She's a liaison for the Redwater Pond Road community, as well as Catherine Page Harris, Assistant Professor of Landscape Architecture and Art and Ecology at UNM, Michaela Shirley, who works with the Indigenous Design and Planning Institute, and graduate student Shunanda Sharman, who is studying landscape architecture. You can find more about this project at our website, kunm.org. Now we move on to our segment about research being done by university students and professors that you might not know about.
Nobody's ever gonna read this!
This is Marty Adam-Smith in the studio with Oliver Baker, PhD candidate here at the Department of English at the University of New Mexico, as well as an Andrew W. Mellon fellow. How are you doing today, Oliver?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, great. Thanks for coming in. We were going to discuss today how your studies of U.S. literature and history lead you to analyze the Trump administration's family separation policy with migrants arriving at the southern border.
But first, before I answer that, my studies, just very briefly, I look at the history of U.S. democracy's relationship to dispossession, colonialism, enslavement, and racism, and how we like to think that we live in a democracy of freedom and equality, but yet all these things are premised on these ugly and violent histories of exclusion and dispossession. And so I study how those things emerge and how they're ongoing today. For example, some of the novels that I use to look at this in the 19th century are ethnic American novels. One is by John Roland Ridge, and the title is The Life and Adventures of Joaquin Murrieta, published in the 1850s. Another is by African-American writer Martin Delaney in his novel Blake. I also look at, later on in the 1930s, African-American writer Ann Petrie in her novel The Street, as well as Native American author Darcy McNichol in his novel The Surrounded. So those kinds of studies help me unpack some of these things that are happening today, since I argue that these are ongoing structures of violence that we are living through. So with this question of the family separation policy, I mean, one way of answering it is that it's not a new thing. We shouldn't be surprised by this, but it's a very old practice of using terror and state violence to punish non-whites as a way to reward and bolster the status of white citizens. And in many ways, that's what white nationalism and border violence has always been about.
Yeah, and one of the ways that I think it became clear to me that the central component of this is race was the LA Times article that we discussed from late April of this year about a man who had been jailed by Immigration and Customs Enforcement for more than 1,000 days, but who was in fact a U.S. citizen.
Yeah, I mean, this article is a great example of what I mean by, like, U.S. citizenship has always been white citizenship. Okay, so they're detaining people who actually are documented, who are citizens, but because their racial appearance is not white, right? They're racialized as brown or black or, you know, non-white. Because of that, they're already seen as non-citizen outsiders. This is why they're being detained. This is why they can be detained with a feeling that these border agents have no consequences to their actions.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of these people are in jail months or up to a year, even though they're U.S. citizens. So it shows us that citizenship is always tied to race and whiteness. And so, you know, for some people who might say, we need to have a border, you can't just have open borders, there's going to be mayhem, chaos, anarchy.
Right.
You know, one of my answers to that would be, for one, let's see this as a racist policy that it is. And number two, U.S. imperialism has gone around the world seeking resources and cheap labor and uses violence to get those things. And mm-hmm. in the process, it displaces people. It creates refugees who then come to our borders seeking refuge. We have an obligation to help the very people we've displaced in the first place. And furthermore, their misery and suffering that they've gone through has already generated the wealth that we have in this country. So all the resources that their suffering has sort of generated, we owe it to them to help them with those very resources we've taken from them in the first place. And so I think that the border gets in the way of that. U.S. nationalism stands in the way of that. And it prevents us from treating people with decency and respect. And of course, that's what white supremacy and white nationalism has always done. It only treats certain people with respect because it treats other people with violence.
Well, great. Thank you so much for coming in, Oliver.
Yeah, it was a pleasure talking. Thank you.
That was Marty Adams Smith with PhD candidate in English, Oliver Baker. This has been University Showcase. You can find this episode and all our previous episodes at KUNM.org. And also, thanks to Professor David Bashwinner for providing the theme music for our show. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks for listening to University Showcase.